Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. ICE arrests have quadrupled in southwest Utah under President Trump. Most arrestees have no criminal convictions. ICE scraps a Salt Lake City detention warehouse that it had planned on doing. And after an election loss, the Utah Senate president threatens to sue four critics for alleged defamation. Later in this program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. We bring in now politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We're going to talk about ICE later on, arrests in southwest Utah with Brooke Larson. Let's talk about Salt Lake City area. ICE scraps Salt Lake City detention warehouse plans. So remind us, they had purchased, I guess, a warehouse going to use this as a detention center?
Yeah. So the ICE had been buying this warehouse space all across the country, a series of them that they were planning to convert into detention centers. And the one they bought in Salt Lake was this massive warehouse in the Inland Port area, kind of out by the airport in the Great Salt Lake. It created a stir, I guess we should say, it was going to house at least 7,500, potentially up to 10,000 detainees while they're awaiting, deportation, presumably. They paid a pretty penny for it. The next step was supposed to be to kind of retrofit this warehouse space to make it a secure facility. It got a lot of pushback from, certain quarters of the population, talking, mostly the more progressive liberal population, who thought it was inhumane to kind of have a detention center of this size and wasteful to spend as much money as they did on it. The Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall and Salt Lake County Mayor Jenny Wilson both sued over this. They said that ICE had kind of pursued this plan without taking into consideration the impacts on things like traffic, health-related issues. Is it equipped for the amount of sewage that would be produced from a facility that size? Because this is intended to be warehouse space, not something where you're going to have a lot of population coming and going. So they had sued over this previously, and about a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, the New York Times first reported that with the new Director of Homeland Security, Mark Wade Mullen, coming in, they were changing course and that they were going to be jettisoning some of these properties that they purchased. So it wasn't a total surprise this week when the parties, the attorneys for both the Department of Homeland Security and for the city and county, filed a joint motion, which means they both agree to this. They're kind of stipulating to this request to pause the litigation so ICE can kind of wind down this facility. This was the first time publicly that ICE and Department of Homeland Security had acknowledged that they are not going to proceed with this facility. And there were, predictably people who had opposed this who were very pleased with that outcome. I mean, they thought it was a bad idea from the start and something that they were relieved to hear was not going to go forward and see it formally in writing, I guess, that this was off the table.
Any word from ICE on why they changed their minds?
Not really. Previously, they had issued a statement that had said that that they still plan to continue these immigration, immigration sweeps and so forth, and that they are doing it with the capacity, the detention capacity that's already existing. So, this was, again, they spent, I should have the story in front of me, but I believe it was about $150 million on this facility. So it's a costly proposition, and then it was going to be even more costly to get it into shape where they could actually house people in it. They are changing course because they frankly probably don't need that much space, and that they are taking a different tack that's potentially going to be more cost efficient. Doesn't mean, and again, in that statement, they did say they remain committed to, these immigration crackdowns that they've been doing since the Trump administration took over.
Governor Cox said he still thinks there should be an ICE detention facility in Utah.
Yeah, this is something that Governor Cox has been pushing for quite a while. As it stands, the immigrants who are being detained are often flown to Las Vegas to be processed, and he thinks that's wasteful and that there should be a facility somewhere in Utah. But he also said it needed to be sort of the right size of facility. And so, he said there are discussions that are ongoing, and they've been having discussions. There are discussions that are ongoing with Homeland Security and ICE. But he still believes that there should be one. And he said that even going back to the Biden administration, there had been talks, and the Biden administration acknowledged that there should be one. So that doesn't, while this is I guess, a win for the opponents of the facility, it's not likely not the last chapter in the saga.
So, a quote in the story, Senator Curtis said he talked with his former colleague in the Senate, Mark Wayne Mullen, who's now Secretary of Homeland Security. Said he put on his mayor's hat, his former mayor's hat, talked about zoning. This is a bad idea to force this kind of thing on a city.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. Addie Baird was at the press availability with Senator Curtis, and it is interesting because he puts on his mayor's hat and he makes a point that was very similar to the point that Mayor Mendenhall and Mayor Wilson were making in their lawsuit. And so it is one of those things where sort of when ICE purchased this facility, they didn't really do it in consultation with anybody. In fact, it was purchased through a shell company, and it was not, even the governor at the time said he was not aware that they were going to be purchasing this facility there. Obviously, he knew that there were talks in place or plans in place that were in consideration to kind of establish a facility, but he was, nobody seemed to be in the loop that this was where they were going to be, what their intention was. And so it did kind of come off as a little heavy-handed and a surprise to a lot of people. So I think that was kind of the point that Senator Curtis was making, is that, if you're going to do this, you need to work with local governments to make sure that they are able and willing to accommodate this type of facility. And in this case, that clearly didn't happen.
House Minority Leader Angela Romero credited community pressure with making this happen.
Yeah, I think maybe that's part of it. I also, as we mentioned, the change in leadership, because you remember we had Kristi Noem running DHS prior to Mark Wayne Mullen taking over for her. And when Director Mullen came in, there just seemed to be a shift in priorities and how they were going to allocate their budget. But that said, I mean, I think between the litigation and the public pushback, they probably recognized that this was going to be a difficult endeavor, and one that they just didn't feel was warranted anymore.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Behind the Headlines, and we're talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. Let's move, Robert, to this story. After election loss, Utah Senate President threatens to sue four critics for alleged defamation. We're talking about Senate President Stuart Adams, who lost in his primary election, so he's a lame duck. Who is he suing?
Yeah, so he's suing four people who have, since his election loss, it's kind of noteworthy, I think, that all of the criticism that he's taking aim at here happened since his election loss. But one of them is State Auditor Tina Cannon, who went on a podcast called the God and Country Podcast, and he's suing the two hosts of that podcast for statements that she made, and they kind of piled on, I guess, that were accusing him of trying to run Tina Cannon out of her Capitol office space. Also, they talked about a story that the Tribune broke about a year ago, about a law that was changed that helped one of Stuart Adams' relative, who was facing a criminal charge at the time, criminal charges at the time, and they talked about that. He said both of the statements they made in both of those situations were false and defamatory, and said that he demanded a retraction. His attorney that wrote the letter demanded a retraction within 14 days, or he would take a or reserve the right, I guess, to take legal action, and they put them on notice that they needed to kind of retain documents and things like that that would be potentially used in any criminal, or not criminal, sorry, in any civil litigation that might stem from this. The other individual he was threatening to sue was Gabby Finlayson. She's a founder, co-founder, and partner in Elevate Strategies, which is a Democratic consulting firm here in town. Similar statements that he said she made that regarding his this relative and the change to the law that made the case lighter sentence, and also statements that she made that Senator Adams had been violating campaign finance laws for years. He said that was false and defamatory. He's never been cited by the Lieutenant Governor's office for violating campaign finance laws. This goes back to a dispute that probably a year and a half, or maybe 2 years ago, where he was not itemizing his expenditures on his campaign finance report. And there was a complaint filed. Ultimately, initially the Lieutenant Governor's office said, yeah, you need to itemize. Stuart Adams pushed back on that. Ultimately, they came to a conclusion that, okay, going forward, you should itemize, but we're not going to issue a citation. So his contention is that he was never cited for a violation, and that statement is false as well. Again, this is a statement that was made in an Instagram post that Gabby posted after the election, sort of wrapping up his defeat. But he has, President Adams said that he's not going to sit idly by and, take these false statements or this slander that's been heaped on him for many years. I think he sees sort of a bright line between when he was running for office, it was fair game. Now that he is not running for office, and as you said, is a lame duck, is not something he's as willing to tolerate anymore. I guess the next question, and I could let you ask the question, I guess, is how are these people going to react? And we talked to all four of them, and frankly, none of them are, they kind of blew it off. I think Tina Cannon's statement was, I refuse to be bullied by President Adams, and I'm certainly not going to be bullied by Mr. Adams, a reference to the fact that he's not going to be president after the end of the year. The podcaster said that, it's odd that he reacted this way because, it's drawing more attention to these statements that he says he was, hurt by. Gabby Finlayson said a similar thing, it's the First Amendment is First Amendment, and she's not going to back down. So I guess now the ball's back in President Adams' court. He gave them 14 days from the day that they received the letter. The letter was dated August 13th. So we'll find out next week, I guess, if he's prepared to take the next step.
What is President Adams, how does he give us more specific on his rebuttal to these allegations, these specific, I guess,
Oh, I
claims?
mean, yeah, I mean, with regard to the change to state law that benefited one of his relatives, he said that, that was never intended to affect that case, and he claims didn't affect that case. He said that, with regards to Tina Cannon's office space, he did not do that out of spite. He wasn't the leading driver behind that. And with the
Let's see, maybe we've lost Robert. Hopefully getting back here. Let's go to a break and see if we can get Robert Gerke back on with us. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and hopefully have back with us Robert Gerke, politics reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Do we have you back, Robert?
Yeah, sorry
Okay,
about that. Some technical difficulties.
Yes, so you were outlining President Adams' rebuttal to these allegations.
Yeah, as I mentioned, he said the change to the law in the criminal case with his relative wasn't intended, and he claims didn't impact the sentence that was handed down. That he was not the driving force behind relocating Tina Cannon's office space, and that he has not been cited for any campaign finance law violations. So all of those statements he said were false, and they said were defamatory toward his character. Like I said, he has said that he's not going to stand by and have people attack his character and defame him and demean him. And so he's taken this action that is really pretty, I don't know if I want to say unprecedented, because maybe it's happened before, but it's unusual, certainly coming from a Senate president, even a lame duck Senate president.
So you talked with University of Utah law professor Ron L. Anderson Jones, who's an expert in the field. This field, what, defamation libel suits? How likely is it that the president will prevail here?
Well, she seemed pretty skeptical, I guess is a fair way to put it. Under the Constitution, under the First Amendment, the First Amendment was created so we can so people can speak and assemble, and and the purpose for that was so you can petition government for redress, right? So there's a heightened protection for any speech involving matters of public interest and political speech in particular. And so there's so President Adams' attorneys would have to show that there was that these people knew those statements were false when they said them, and they either did it intentionally or with reckless disregard for the truth. And so it's a standard called actual malice, and it's very, very difficult for to show that. And so plus there's a state statute called UPEPA, Uniform Protection of Expression of Public Expression. I'm mangling the name now, but basically it's an anti-slap law that allows parties that are sued move to have the case dismissed and collect attorney's fees if it's found that the lawsuit was intended to stifle their free speech on a matter of public interest. So it's pretty unlikely that he would prevail on this lawsuit, but ultimately that's going to be up to a judge if he gets that far to decide.
All right, we'll see what happens. We're talking with Robert Gerke, politics reporter for Salt Lake Tribune. We have time for one more story here. This is an interesting update. The headline, Utah's new public records chief is deciding cases twice as fast as the committee, but not everyone's happy. So remind us, before and after this new law from the legislature, we had a committee, now we have a public records chief.
Yeah, to set this up a little bit, let's just sort of lay out what we're talking about here. Utah has this open records law called GRAMOG, the Government Records Access and Management Act. And this is how members of the public and members of the press can file a request and get these public records, public documents from government entities about how government's functioning. And so when there is a dispute between the government entity and the requester about whether the records should be released, those appeals have gone to, in the past, they went to a state records committee, a 7-member board, to decide whether they should be released. We talked about this last year. The legislature changed that, disbanded the records committee, and replaced it with a government records officer, a director of the government records office. His name's Lonnie Pearson. So now all of these appeals are being decided by one individual. And so that one individual, it was a contested, I guess, a disputed change to the law, because a lot of people liked the Records Committee and didn't think it needed to be changed. Senator Mike McKell said at the time that it was taking too long for the Records Committee to get through these requests. They had a big backlog of appeals that had been sort of waiting, and he wanted to go this route. So Lonnie got on the job at the end of June of last year. So I decided it was a good point in time to kind of look at how it's gone in the first year. And as you mentioned from the headline, he's getting through them a lot faster, which makes sense. The Record Committee would generally meet once a month and get through and have long-ish hearings, and get through, four or five appeals a month. They issued, I think, 74 in their last year that they were in existence. Lonnie's upped that. He got through 147, so nearly twice as many. And when you look at the 3-year average of what the Records Committee was doing, it is more than twice as many of the appeals. The rate, the next question then becomes, well, is the public and the are the public and the media requesters or appellants faring as well in front of them, and it's kind of close. That one's, I think, the jury might still be out on a little bit, because under the records committee, the appellants, the members of the public and the press who were going to before the records committee, prevailed about 40% of the time. Under the new structure with Mr. Pearson in charge, it's about a third of the time, so slightly less. I mean, I think we need to maybe gather some more data over the coming months and figure out if there is a more decisive trend there, or if this is, just kind of it obviously is very dependent on what types of appeals come before them. So I think we need to kind of let this one come out in the wash a little bit.
Some of your story talked about that maybe since Mr. Pearson is getting through these faster, that more people think, well, I'm gonna take a long shot. Maybe my case isn't as meritorious, and then that's skewing the results, maybe.
Yeah, that was something he had brought up. He said they're getting a lot of appeals that seem to be generated with AI, and so because you can get through an appeal in a matter of weeks rather than months, that it's like, well, might as well give it a shot, right? If it was something like went through with the records committee, at some points you'd be waiting months for your appeal, and so he thinks people would walk away and abandon those. That's possible. It's also interesting. I mean, looking at some of the types of appeals he's decided, there was, after the shooting of Charlie Kirk down in UVU, there were a lot of appeals filed by media outlets from all across the country who were trying to get records related to the security precautions that were in place. And those are ty the types of records that typically are not released. And so, thing to mention some of the others that he has ruled on. There was a dispute over whether or not St. George, remember St. George banned drag performances and then had to pay a settlement in a lawsuit. And one of the Tribune reporters, Mark Eddington, tried to get a copy of that settlement. And he ruled it should be public, but it was sealed by the court. So once it was unsealed by the court, his ruling was that it should be public. So that's the type of thing he's ruling on. A lot of parents trying to get records related to their kids or discipline of their kids in the school system, that sort of thing. And this is probably a good place to segue to what Jeff Hunt said. Jeff
No,
Hunt's a
that's
media
true.
attorney. Jeff Hunt's an attorney who helped create the open records law back 35, 33 years ago. And he said the reason that this is important, he says, is because it provides the public with that insight into how their government's functioning and allows them to engage in that process in a meaningful way. If it didn't exist, there would be a whole slew of things that the public wouldn't have any real insight on into how their government works. And so he says that that's why this is important. That's why the law that's in place is important, and that's why this appeals process matters.
All right, yeah, interesting update. Yeah, I'm glad you did that.
Yeah, we'll take a look at it again down the road and see how these trends hold up.
Right. Well, we've been talking with politics reporter from Salt Lake Tribune, Robert Gerke, on this part of the program. Robert, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Sorry about the little glitch there,
Oh,
but
no, no, no worries. Hope you
all
have a great
right.
weekend.
Yeah, you as well. Take care.
Okay, bye now. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a break, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Here's the headline: ICE arrests have quadrupled in Southwest Utah under President Trump. Most arrestees have no criminal convictions. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. In this part of the program, we turn to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about a couple of stories here. We'll start with this one. The headline is ICE arrests have quadrupled in Southwest Utah under President Trump. Most arrestees have no criminal convictions. You did this story with data columnist Andy Larson. I guess maybe let's start where you did in the story. You kind of personalized this story. A man in St. George going to his construction job is pulled over. Tell me what happens.
Yeah, so Hippolito, who was living in Washington County, woke up like usual early. He said around 4:30 a.m. in the morning, and left for his construction job. It was February, and he stopped at a gas station where he grabbed coffee and breakfast. And as he was driving away, he saw emergency lights flashing behind him, and checked his speed, turn signal, all these things to make sure there was nothing wrong on his end. And he said everything was fine. But he was pulled over, and in that process, was found to be an undocumented. And so the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency who pulled him over arrested him. And a few days later after that, he was deported to Mexico, where he is originally from.
So wife and three children, I believe.
Yep. So his wife was also in Washington County, and three children. One of those was born in the U.S., only about 1 year old. The others, were also born in Mexico, and the wife and the children have pending asylum cases. They came to the U.S. after Hippolito, fleeing cartel violence in Mexico.
The wife, Marilyn, she emphasizes that, right? That especially the children, she didn't feel were safe. And they were from Chiapas, I think.
Yeah, exactly. She said the cartels threatened to kidnap her children. She, was a small business owner, and so they were threatening her just with some of the violence happening and the economic situation happening in Chiapas. But even though they felt safer in the U.S., it became unsustainable for them without Hippolito there, their husband. Marilyn was having to work more, and they had some support from other family that was in Washington County, but they also had to work. And at a certain point, her oldest son had to stay home to watch, the younger children. And so once the school year ended this spring, they also decided to self-deport. So they're all back in Mexico now.
So Hippolito admitted he was in the country illegally. He overstayed a visa, which is, as you point out, the story is a civil offense, not a criminal. As you point out with Andy in the story, national officials and local officials have said they're going after the dangerous criminals. But what did you find?
Yeah, and one other thing before I dive into that I'll just add about Hippolito's case. He did initially come into the U.S. legally, on a temporary work visa. He worked at a farm in Florida and then in Wisconsin, and then eventually did overstay that visa. And Isabel Inosco, a Utah immigration attorney, said that's a very common situation, a very common story for undocumented immigrants in the U.S., as they often initially enter legally and then overstay and then, become undocumented. So that's just some additional context about his case. And the data, as you asked about, earlier this year, Washington County, which has two 287G agreements, which are these agreements that sheriff's office can form with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to basically either assist with arrests or identify potential undocumented immigrants in jails, things like that. So Washington County has been assisting ICE in those ways. They also provide bed space at the Purgatory Correctional Facility in Washington County for ICE for immigration arrests. So that's sort of how the county and ICE have been working together. And earlier this year, the former sheriff said that, the county is and ICE are going after the worst of the worst. And Andy Larson, colleague at the Tribune, data columnist, and I looked at data through a few different sources. There's a mutual aid group called Manos Amigos Utah that has been tracking bookings with an immigration customs hold on which are posted on the sheriff's office website every week. So they've been tracking those since August 2025, and they shared their list with us. We also were able to look at data that ICE has provided to the Deportation Data Project in response to Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits. And then finally, I also put in a record request under Utah's Government Records and Management Act for booking records from the sheriff's office that have this immigration customs hold. And we have kind of different time frames for all of these. And so Andy in this story did a very good job explaining these different data sets and the different timelines we have. Unfortunately, for things like the Deportation Data Project, which we felt was, the most thorough and the data we felt most comfortable going by without doing our own independent checking, since it came through that FOIA request. That list only goes till March, where things like the Manos Amigos Utah spreadsheet, which we have not been able to ourselves confirm every single arrest on there. So we included the numbers, and they're very similar to the numbers that are on the Deportation Data Project spreadsheet. But yeah, but just, we were working with kind of limited and diverse data sources to find this, but overall, found that the worst of the worst description doesn't fit what's actually happening on the ground.
Let me start with, I guess, just the overall quantity. I think if I'm getting this right, from Biden to Trump too, quadruple the number of arrests.
Yeah, yep. So, Andy found through that data analysis that, the average arrest per month for the St. George ICE field office was around 10 per month during the Biden administration and jumped to around 48 per month since Trump's inauguration.
And then this one stood out to me. The share of the percentage of arrestees with criminal convictions fell from about 84% under Biden to about 45% under Trump.
Yeah, that is right.
Yeah, so that seems to go contrary to what the administration's saying, what the sheriff was saying. They're just targeting the worst of the worst. There seem to be quite a few. Just have a, maybe a civil infraction, overstaying a visa, or without any other, criminal activity other than coming in illegally.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting. Andy broke down the data even further of like felony versus misdemeanor versus aggravated felony. And we even see like, the more severe crimes like aggravated felony or felony dropping under the Trump administration and more of the people that are being arrested and detained under the Trump administration having misdemeanors rather than, these more serious charges.
Tell me a little bit more about Manos Amigos. It's interesting how that formed.
Yeah, so that formed when Sarah Thomas, who lives in Washington County, saw, and heard about a resident, a neighbor being someone being arrested in her neighborhood. She then went on to the Washington County booking page and just did, Command F, immigration, and the website lit up with a lot of people who had been booked under this immigration customs hold, is how it's listed on the Washington County Sheriff's Office booking page. And that really stood out to her, and she decided that she wanted to track that, so those names wouldn't be lost, those people wouldn't be lost. And as that started, more and more people got involved, and now they do several things in the community. They do grocery deliveries to families who have been affected by immigration enforcement. Families like Maryland, how Manos Amigas got connected with Marilyn, the woman that is in this story, was, after Hippolito was arrested. Marilyn heard about Manos Amigas, Utah, from someone at her church and reached out to them, and they started delivering groceries and baby formula and diapers and things like that to her to help with, just the financial burden of losing an income provider, her husband, to deportation. They also help families with like family preparedness plans. So that's basically, in the situation that a parent or both parents are arrested, detained, deported, that there's a plan in place for who is going to then, have rights to care for the children. They also support families like who are trying to communicate with, a loved one that has been arrested. So in this case, the story we talk about, Manos Migas did also help Marilyn and Hippolito communicate when, he was initially arrested, or like at least figure out some of what initially was going on as much as they could. There's obviously some limits in that, especially when people are moved quickly, but that's another thing they try to help with.
I think it's probably fairly typical. You know, in the story of Marilyn, once Hippolito was arrested, she kept the children out of school, right? They just stayed close to home. They were obviously afraid of being deported themselves, even though eventually they did self-deport. Tell me a bit about, I was interested to see Hippolito's working conditions when he came on a visa, both a couple of times, once in Florida, once to Wisconsin. Tell me about the work he was doing.
Yeah, so he was doing, various type like agricultural type work, and he said both of those places, both the jobs he had in Florida and Wisconsin, had poor working conditions, that he was often expected to work until midnight or 1 a.m., like much longer than the 8 hour shifts they were supposed to work. In Wisconsin, he was working outdoors in rain, sleet, snow, freezing conditions. Just, yeah, he said it was very rough working conditions. But he did say his work in Washington County was generally much better conditions. So, I mean, that is just like an interesting case, and, something we didn't dive in a ton into this story, but just that these were jobs he had on, these work visas, and the conditions were still quite difficult from his story.
Finally, I think you heard from at least Marilyn, right, that Hippolito and Marilyn and the kids are back in Mexico. How are things right now?
Yeah, I've heard, that they're happy to be together, but they are challenging, like the financial instability, the reasons that Hippolito came to the US and made the decision to overstay his visas, primarily because it's just very hard to financially provide for his family with the economic opportunities in Chiapas right now with the cartels, is what they told me. And they said that has only worsened since they left Mexico. They said that criminal organizations, cartels, have even more control now in, the area they live. So They do hope to one day return to the US if immigration policies change and that becomes possible. And, like I said, Marilyn and two of her children still have pending asylum cases. But, I have heard from immigration attorneys that once you leave, it can become much more difficult to return in a legal way. So I do think there's challenges ahead for them, definitely, if they want to pursue that route.
Well, thanks for telling us about the story, Brooke Larson, Salt Lake Tribune reporter. I want to go to another story. This is from last week, but I think a very important story, Brooke. Here's the headline: Pain and Suffering, What the Fed's Lake Powell Proposal Means for Utah and Other Colorado River States. We're talking about Bureau of Reclamation releasing a environmental impact statement. So they're a big player in this, not the final word, but a big player here. So, and the pain and suffering, when I'm reading the stories, it seems like more the lower basin states than the upper basin. So that seemed like a big difference between the upper basin. The Bureau of Reclamation is recommending voluntary conservation measures. Lower basin states, they're mandating some in under this plan, mandating a bunch of cuts. Why the difference?
Yeah, so like you said, lower basin definitely could lose a lot more in this, could be forced to cut significantly on their water use while that's not being forced in the upper basin. And that's largely because this is a federal plan and the federal government has very limited authority when it comes to water regulation, regulating at least water rights in the upper basin, in states like Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming. In the lower basin, on the Colorado River system, the Secretary of the Interior is considered the water master, and directly controls the delivery out of Lake Mead to downstream states. So, in Utah, we get Colorado River water through a ton of different tributaries, Green River, the Price River, smaller creeks, and things like that. So those are, within Utah, the water rights on those in Utah are regulated by the state engineer. And the Bureau of Reclamation doesn't have, dams on all of these places that's controlling if that water is going downstream or not. They do have some, but it's just a very different setup where in the lower basin, pretty much most of the water that's going to states like California, Arizona, and Nevada is coming out of Lake Mead. And so there's a lot more control the federal government has in the lower basin.
So, what are they under this plan? What are they recommending for the upper basin states? How much water would they like the upper basin states to conserve?
Yeah, so they've set a goal of 200,000 acre feet of conservation. And that is not like set as an annual goal. It's honestly very loose, at least in this federal plan. Jean Shawcroft, Utah's Colorado River negotiator, said that would take a few years for states like Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming to actually conserve and contribute to the system. So in the lower basin, which is 3 million acre feet potentially annually, depending on how dry it is.
That would, understand from the story, really hit Arizona hard and tribes.
Yeah, so Arizona could be particularly hit hard by this just because of kind of seniority of water rights in the lower basin and what water rights they hold and things like that. And 22 of the 30 federally recognized tribes in the Colorado River Basin are in Arizona. So, this could particularly affect them. Some of those tribes have very senior water rights, but some don't, and there's still, concerns of what that could mean when there are tribes that haven't been able to develop all their water rights, or In Arizona, 10 of the 11 tribes that still have unresolved water rights, meaning they haven't, been able to secure those through Congress, through a court decision. 10 of those are in Arizona as well. So there's just concerns about what this could mean for tribes, given that so many in the basin are in Arizona.
So this is Bureau of Reclamation, right? One of the players. The compact is, I guess, probably the most important, one of the most important documents. And what would this do to that important meter, we could call it Lee's Ferry, right? A certain amount of water needs to be, under the compact, needs to be flowing to the lower basin states.
So, one aspect of this proposal from the federal government is that, Lake Powell, the Bureau of Reclamation may re release l less water out of Lake Powell in particularly dry years. And so one concern with that is that means less water is flowing past Lee Ferry, this dividing line between the upper and lower basin. And there is this line in the Colorado River Compact that says, the upper basin states will not cause the flow of the river at Lee Ferry to fall below a particular number over a 10-year period. And if we have consistent low releases at the level of 5 million acre feet, it's going to fall below that. So, that brings up a high likelihood that states like Arizona might sue upper basin states, including Utah. It also might mean Arizona or other lower basin states sue the federal government because the federal government is, putting forward this plan to do these releases. So, sources I talked to did say that this could likely lead to legal challenges.
Well, I guess one more thing on this. The Bureau of Reclamation prioritizes dam infrastructure. They want to keep it above power pool, right, for those two big dams. And you talked to Jack Schmidt at USU. He's among other experts saying it's going to be pretty dry. We'd are we going to? So that's kind of a competing priority. And as I said, Bureau of Reclamation only one of the players here. Could we see a situation where we deprioritize the dams to keep the water flowing?
I think that is the question on a lot of people's minds, Tom. You mentioned Jack Schmidt. He's a senior research scientist at Utah State, former director of the Center for Colorado River Studies. So he's been looking at this for a long time, and just points out that even in Reclamation's analysis, the agency itself says that, even large and unprecedented reductions may be needed and may not be enough to stabilize storage. And that's basically because we have this climate change-induced drought. The system keeps on getting drier and drier, and until we fully accept that and adapt accordingly, we may just keep being in this situation. And I will say that federal agencies publicly have spoken very optimistically about, Glen Canyon Dam and the infrastructure there, but in their document, in their analysis, they repeatedly emphasize the importance of keeping water above this level. This minimum power pool level, and even a little bit above that, where some infrastructure damage can begin to occur. So it's clear they don't want that to happen. They are doing basically an appraisal study to look into what it may cost to re-engineer the dam. So I think maybe next year, who knows when they'll actually come out with the results of that. We may have more info on what could be possible to re-engineer the dam. But Lake Powell hit a record low last weekend. Lake Mead has as well. The reservoirs are getting very, very low. So it is opening up conversations about does it actually make sense to have these reservoirs as we currently do when they're not near their full capacity at all.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson, talking about a couple important stories here. Brooke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Our thanks to you for listening. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.